Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, boy, do I have a fascinating guest. Professor Richard Nisbet of the University of Michigan. This could be the most influential academic that the average person has never heard of. His work has touched on everything from psychology to intelligence to childhood and child rearing to pharmaceutical side effects. It's just endlessly astonishing who he is, the research he's done, understanding the impact of culture and society on just how we think and how different, let's just use East versus West as examples, as different parts of the world approach problem solving and societal issues and economics, and just endlessly fascinating. He's written a dozen books, the most recent of which is Thinking, a memoir, which was quite fascinating. He's one of these people, I don't want to say he name dropped because he worked with all these people, but he just so casually works in various characters from, you know, the canon of 20th century psychology and economics and academia, because he was really there as all these things were being developed. I mentioned during the interview, Professor David Dunning of Dunning-Kruger is the one who said, hey, I work with Richard Nisbet. You should really talk to him. And really, what more do you need than that as an introduction? I wish we had another 2 hours. The conversation was absolutely fascinating. It's a deep dive into intelligence and thinking and how we get smarter, both as individuals and society. Absolutely fascinating. I'm going to stop here and say, with no further ado, my conversation with Richard Nisbet.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My extra special guest this week is Professor Richard Nisbet. He is the co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan, focusing on culture and reasoning and basic cognitive processes. No less than Malcolm Gladwell called him the most influential thinker in my life. And when Professor David Dunning, yes, that Dunning, offered to make an introduction, I jumped at the chance. Professor Richard Nisbet, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to have you. Before we dive in, I just want to give you a little bit about my background, because I have no real psychology background. My bias is the world of behavioral finance and cognitive errors, really in the context of investing decisions, especially bad investing decisions. So pardon some of the naivete that I may exhibit in some of my questions. There's like the slightest bit of overlap between what I've looked at and your whole career, and that's why I found it so interesting. And let's start with your career. There's nothing really in your background, growing up in El Paso and in California, that suggests an academic career in psychology. What led you to the study of human reasoning and decision-making?
Oh, I think it was just lock and key. that's what I was meant to do. But I learned it very early, fortunately. I read Calvin Hall's Primer of Freudian Psychology, and it was just zap, that's it, that's what I'm going to do.
Right, interesting. I really like the idea that has been talked about, and you reference it in your book, Thinking, a Memoir, which we'll talk about in a few moments, that the human propensity for flawed reasoning was advantageous on the savannah, but it really doesn't serve us well in a modern society. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, there's a whole enterprise I'm sure you're aware of in psychology and economics showing that people's reasoning is flawed in many respects. And most of it was, many people said, well, that can't be. You know, I managed to get through my day pretty well. that's sometimes self-delusional, but by and large, it's correct to say we're not terrible at reasoning across the boards. It's just that the Industrial Revolution and then in spades, the Information Revolution, just changed the nature of what we need to do in our reasoning in everyday life. It gave us data, it gave us numbers, it gave us graphs, it gave us reports from people that we never heard of. We encounter people that we don't know at all. All of this is just completely unanticipatable from the life of a hunter-gatherer. So the problem is the rug has been pulled out from under us, so we make errors all the time.
Quite interesting. Some of the research that you've done on cognition is really quite fascinating because it's so challenging to figure out what's actually going on in people's minds. I was kind of intrigued by some of the research that was done on birth order and how that impacts people's career choices and aversion to risk-taking or not. Tell us a little bit, or even how they embrace riskier sports. Tell us a little bit about birth order and how did you figure out that was significant?
Well, I was my advisor in graduate school at Columbia, Stanley Schachter, studied birth order, and one thing he discovered is that firstborn females are more frightened of the prospect of electric shock than later-born females. And I thought, that's interesting, because I've always been kind of afraid of getting hurt, and my younger brother was getting hurt all the time when he was a kid. So I sort of filed that away, and then I heard of one of these people who looks at primates, and she studied monkeys, and she just made this offhand observation that when a monkey mother has her first baby, she's all arms and legs and tail to keep it in the tree to keep it from falling 30 feet down from the forest canopy. By the time her fourth or fifth kid has come along, the kid falls out of the tree. She says, oh, damn, I'm going to have to pick the thing up. Firstborns are protected in a way that laterborns aren't. So I said, how can I test this? And I started looking at sports and the birth order of people who play dangerous sports versus non-dangerous sports. And it turns out that a laterborn is about 50% more likely to play a dangerous sport than a firstborn. So... and that's, I just found out recently, there have been 20 studies since, all supporting that general statistic.
And 50% is a giant number. We're usually looking for a couple of percent here or there to identify some difference of note. This is clearly not only replicable, but very significant.
Yeah, it's surprisingly strong. If I'd been predicting what I'd find, I'd say, oh, maybe a 10 or 15% edge, but no, it's huge.
So another one of your books, Geography of Thought, you put forth the theory Asians and Westerners have maintained very different systems of thought for thousands of years, and these differences are scientifically measurable. Now that's when it was first introduced, was a pretty radical premise, but you had the data to back it up. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, it is a radical premise, and I just happened to have a student a number of years ago from China, a really brilliant guy who's actually now dean of social sciences at Tsinghua University, which is the top university in China. And after we'd been working together for a while, he said, you know, Dick, you and I think completely differently about a lot of different kinds of things. And I said, well, tell me more. And he gave me a version of the following. He said, you think very analytically, very linearly. When you look at some object or person, you're thinking, what are the attributes of that object or person? And you come up with rules, or you consult your rules about that kind of object or person to figure out how it's going to react, how it's going to behave. He said, I, as Chinese, think much more holistically. I pay much more attention to the context of everything, objects and people. I pay attention to relationships. I pay attention to similarities. And this produces all kinds of different conclusions between you and me looking at the same situation. Now, that's actually, he didn't quite say all of that, but he said stuff that was similar to that, and what I just said is a summary of our results. And speaking of big effects, not everything I do gets big effects, I can assure you. But I didn't actually believe him exactly, although I had read a book by Nakamura called Ways of Thinking of Eastern People. So I was prepared for some differences, certainly not the differences as large as we found. My favorite examples of these cognitive differences really have to do with perception more than reasoning, although there are plenty of big differences for reasoning. In one of our studies, and this was done with Takahiko Masuda, we showed underwater scenes to Americans and Japanese for 20 seconds. And then we asked them, tell me what you saw. The Americans will say something like, well, I saw three big fish swimming off to the left. They had one fin on top. They had pink stipples on their bellies. There were rocks and shells on the bottom, and so on. The Japanese nearly always start with the context. They say, I saw what looked like a stream. The water was green. There were rocks and plants on the bottom. There were three big fish swimming off to the left. Now, in total, we got 60% more reports about context from the Japanese, from the Americans, than from the Americans, and 100% more observations about relationships, like the frog was on the lily pad. It turns out, the difference there between number of observations about the context, it's a 60% increase over what Americans do. And that's done with no loss of information about the central objects. So we wanted to see, well, what are they doing? What are they looking at this thing differently? And the answer is yes, they are. We put a gizmo on their heads with a camera back at their eye, so we know where they're looking at every moment. This is done with still photos. We show people the photos for 10 or 20 seconds. What we find is that the Americans spend almost all their time looking at the object, the front of it, the back of it, the top of it, the bottom of it, etc. The Japanese spend much, much more time on the context and they're actually constantly looking back and forth between the context and the object. So they're not just seeing the object and the context. They're seeing relationships between the object and the context. So the effects are huge for perception. There are some very large effects for cognition as well, which I can tell you about if you're interested.
For sure.
One thing that we do, we do very simple studies to make our points. We show people a picture of a monkey, let's take a better example. We show people a picture of a cow, grass, and a monkey. And we say, which two of these pictures go together? The Americans say, well, the monkey and the cow go together because they're both animals. The Asians are much more likely to say, well, the cow and the grass go together because the cow eats the grass. So they're seeing relationships automatically that are not so salient to us, and they're paying much more attention to the object. Some of the more consequential differences have to do with understanding human behavior. There is an error in reasoning that people make. I wonder how many of your guests have heard of this error. It's called the fundamental attribution error.
Sure.
So we tend to attribute the causes of behavior to a person's attributes. That is, his personality, his abilities, his attitudes, and we tend to ignore the context. East Asians are much more likely to pick up on the context and to attribute behavior to the context than we are. An example of this is we do a study where we say, we've asked this person you're about to hear from, we've asked him to please state the case as if you were in a debate for why marijuana should be legalized or some other topic. And so we say either this person gave this talk in response to a psychology professor's request, in response to a political science assignment, or in response to a debate coach who said, I want you to give me the pro argument as if you were in a debate. And people then hear this speech, and now you ask them, what do you suppose this guy actually thinks? People are hugely influenced by what he's said, even though they know he was chosen randomly to give this particular talk. Now, Asians, East Asians, when I say Asians, I nearly always mean East Asians, Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans, but others as well, tell people, they've been told that this person was required to give this speech. What do they think? They tell us, Americans tell us, well, he thinks pretty much what he said. Asians don't do this. I don't really know what he thinks because he was assigned to do this by somebody else. And that effect is really huge. I mean, we make the error in that situation, a very big error, that they are much less likely to make. They do make the fundamental attribution error also, but it's just not nearly as frequently and not nearly as strong an effect.
We're going to talk more about the fundamental attribution error in a little bit, but I have to ask, what is the societal or cultural basis for this difference between looking at things either with or without context and relationships, and how does it manifest itself in each society? Clearly, there's a different structure in both, and the behaviors and economies and everything else are so different. Tell us a little bit about what leads to this and then where it goes from there.
Well, first of all, I'll point out, as you did earlier, that the differences go back thousands of years. For example, if you look at physics beliefs in the West and in the East, it turns out Westerners have always tended to have physical beliefs, which were a variety of the fundamental attribution error. They try to explain the behavior of objects purely in terms of properties of the object. So, you know, the object fell because it's heavy. The Eastern says, well, the object fell because the material supporting it wasn't sufficient to bear the weight. So they understand the relation between the context and the object. And 2,500 years ago already, Chinese were well aware of the concept of action at a distance. So they understood the reason for the tides, for example, which was not understood even by Galileo. He didn't get it right. And they also had a good concept of magnetism and of acoustics. So they had very accurate lay intuitive physics as compared to Westerners. Hmm. Now, so that, and the category, and the logic, by the way, apropos of analytic reasoning, logic was, the story goes, invented by Aristotle because he got sick of hearing lousy arguments in the marketplace and the political assembly. So he said, okay, can we agree that if your argument has this structure, it's a lousy argument? Logic was formalized very early in the West. It was never very much of an interest in the East, and it was never formalized. And there was only a very brief period in the 3rd century B.C. When there was any concern with logic at all. And then it basically dropped out of the intellectual armaments of the East. So why do we get these perceptual differences and these cognitive differences and also, as a consequence, the social differences? I believed early on, without much evidence, that it was because of the type of economy that East Asians had versus Europeans. East Asians had a great, especially in China, I mean, terrific circumstances for mass agriculture. Mass agriculture, especially rice culture, demands lots of cooperation from people. So effective action depends on my looking at what you're doing and understanding the relationship between your action and my action and so on. So I'm constantly looking out there, and I'm seeing the reasons for behavior. I'm seeing the context that creates them. And incidentally, if I'm paying attention out there, I have better understanding of physics. Then I had a very sharp Turkish student a while back what was the situation in Greece? Well, Greece was mountains descending to the sea. Mass agriculture is just not in the cards in that situation. People do make a living by trading and fishing and kitchen gardening and so on. So it's, they don't have to pay attention to, and then herding, sheep herding, especially goats. So they don't have to pay attention to other people in order to lead an effective life. So this Turkish student says, well, I know an interesting town in Turkey where there are three major occupations, farmers, fishers, and herders. Now, if you guys are right about why people think holistically in the East and analytically in the West, then we ought to find that the farmers and the fishers think more holistically than the herders. And that turns out to be true. So the herder sees the monkey and the cow as being related, and the farmers and the fishers see the cow and the grass to be related. And so then the really beautiful study on this was a former student of mine looked at reasoning in China, saying, well, people ought to be more holistic in South China than in North China because you make your living historically in the South by rice farming, which is extremely social dependent. I mean, you can't do anything without lots of people cooperating. And it's wheat farming in the north of China, which is much less dependent on other people. Sure enough, people reason more holistically in the south of China than in the north of China. So quite, that's a very long answer to your question.
No, but it's quite fascinating. Some of the things I found in the book were really fascinating and curious, and there's a thread that runs through all of this that is just intriguing. I want to start with something that I thought was an urban legend, but you present it very differently. One of the few factors that predicts success as a scientist is the amount of time in childhood that person is sick. So explain that.
Well, my theory about that is, I mean, who knows? It's a fact. We don't really know why. But my theory is that if you're sick, you spend a lot of time in bed by yourself, and there's not much to do. This is pre-TV. There's not much to do but read and think. This is going to stand you in good stead for certain kinds of occupations. Actually, I think most occupations. Then the reason that's in my book, other than the fact that it's sort of an interesting tidbit, is that I spent a huge amount of time alone wandering the area of El Paso, Texas, which is right across the border from Juarez. And it was a wonderful place to wander around. I would go down to the Rio Grande. I would go to the irrigation canals and look at the catfish and the crayfish. There was a kind of motel for Mexican farm workers that I would go down and visit those folks, usually taking a bunch of Walt Disney comics, which I had paid 10 cents for, and I charged them 5 cents. Much later, I realized this is a Pareto improving exchange. I got some money, which for my comics, and they got their comics cheaper than they would have had to pay for them in the store. I wandered around a lot, so I was thinking a lot, and I was something of an isolate. There were not other kids in my neighborhood, so I did a lot of reading. So these days that wouldn't happen. You'd be doing looking at Instagram or playing video games.
Right. There's no downtime, and there's potential negative ramifications for that.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So, right. So let's talk about some of your other research that is somewhat intriguing. Telling people about drug side effects has no impact on them, and this eventually leads to regulation about all the drug disclosures we see on pharmaceuticals and TV ads for different drugs. You're credited or blamed, or at least your research is credited or blamed, for those disclosures. Tell us how you came to that conclusion.
Well, very early on, I did a study where I asked people to take a series of electric shocks of increasing intensity. And I asked them to tell, when can you first feel it? When does it first become painful? And when is it too painful to bear? By the way, a lot of people say, well, I would walk out of the room. No, you wouldn't. Everybody, they try to be cooperative. I mean, I present it as a reasonable thing for them to be doing for science, and people will do it. But for some of these people, I say, I want you to take this pill. It's called Suproxone. It will cause your heart to race a bit. It will make your breathing heavier and more irregular. You may find that your palms are a little bit sweaty. You may get a tightness feeling in your stomach. These are the symptoms people experience when you're giving them electric shock.
Right.
They're the arousal symptoms that just come with the territory. Other people, we say it'll just give them a few junk symptoms. It'll cause headache and some itching. And sure enough, and this is, for some reason you're asking about things, all the big effect studies I've ever done, an enormous effect. The people who've been told that the arousal will accompany the drug take four times the amperage of other people. And by the way, and this opens up a line of work which we may want to talk about later, the reasoning here is completely unconscious. You ask people, tell me, what did you think about the drug while you were taking the shock? And they say, oh, I wasn't thinking about the drug at all. Oh, yes, they were. And what they were thinking was, they're getting more and more aroused as this thing, that, sure enough, their heart rate, their breathing patterns and so on are changing just like we said they would. They attribute the arousal, which otherwise would be multiplying the pain experience. They're treating it as an external thing. It has nothing to do with, my thoughts or emotions or anything else. It's just that drug that caused those symptoms. I did one other study which showed a therapeutic outcome kind of thing. I advertised for insomniacs. This was done at Yale with Yale students for a study on dreams, allegedly. So I found out how long it took them to get to sleep the previous two nights before they come into the lab. I tell them, for the next two nights, I want you to take this pill before you go to sleep, and it's an arousal pill. It's going to cause, your breathing may become irregular, your heart rate may become faster, et cetera. All the arousal symptoms, other people, we say nothing to about the effects of this pill, or we actually say it will reduce their arousal symptoms. And our anticipation was, this is based on myself as an insomniac. I used to, lie in bed and, thinking about the day and the future, and there were things I was concerned about, and I'd start thinking about them, and I'd get kind of worked up, and so I said, I'm getting aroused at bedtime. That's a very bad idea. So we anticipated and found that the people that we had given the arousal instructions to got to sleep more quickly the nights that they took the pill. The people, we said, the pill will will reduce your arousal, took longer to get to sleep.
Huh.
Because we're thinking, you know, the arousal that they experience because of they're worried about the situation with their girlfriend or the hour exam tomorrow, whatever, though the arousal that occurs as a result of these scary, unpleasant thoughts, they'll say, well, it must be particularly bad tonight because I've got this pill that's supposed to calm me down. And by the way, that was based on a personal experience as well. After I'd had insomnia for quite a while as an undergraduate, I said, okay, I'm going to give up. I'm going to take a sleeping drug. And I took a Somanex and lay in bed waiting for it to take effect, which it never did, and it took me longer to get to sleep because I thought, well, this ought to get rid of those arousal symptoms that I have, and it didn't. So years later, somebody said, well, Somanex is practically useless, so it was never going to have an effect.
So what's the relationship?
People who've taken the pill at bedtime and think it will reduce arousal, it takes them longer to get to sleep because they think, look, I've got at least as much arousal as usual, and even though I've got a pill in me. So the general point made by those two studies is that you can have the effects of a pill that aren't really there. Their arousal is not being produced by that pill or reduced by that pill, but by other experiences. So this work got picked up by the FDA because drug companies did not want to tell people about the side effects that they might have from the drug because they said, well, the power of suggestion. We're psychologists here, and we know that the power of suggestion is such that people are going to be experiencing these things that they're not really have anything to do with the pill, but they're going to attribute, they'll invent these effects. They'll start having these effects if you tell them about it because via the power of suggestion.
So let me jump in here and ask a quick question. What's the relationship between the expected physiological arousal in this external source and what I think lay people think of as the placebo effect?
Well, the placebo effect is, in fact, you get certain symptoms, certain experiences, and if you've been given what is actually a placebo and told that it will improve your condition, the pain or your flu symptoms or whatever, people will, in fact, often experience those things or think that they're experiencing those things. So there is definitely a phenomenon of the placebo effect, but in a way, this is the opposite of the effect. I mean, this pill is not causing any symptoms of any kind, but they think that the pill is causing certain symptoms. So, but it very much depends on the symptoms. If it's arousal symptoms, they will attribute any naturally occurring arousal to the pill. And if it's decreasing arousal symptoms, they'll attribute any arousal to their own state, to their actual state, which they will assume is worse than they might have thought. So you can read into people's experiences arousal that's due to some external source, or you can read it out. So the FDA requires that all possible side effects be reported. You mentioned David Dunning earlier, you've had on your program, and he's done a fascinating study showing that people who have been just a second. Let me make sure I get the story right about what he's finding. Yeah, Dunning has found that people are less likely to pay attention to side effects if you list 27 side effects, you know, like the TV ads where they and this may call you, blah 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 blah. The more symptoms you give them, the less attention they pay to any of them, and the less likely they are to remember it later. If you just tell them a few of the very most important ones, they're likely to retain that information. So, you know, psychology has a lot to do with what drug effects are and what drug side effects are and what people attribute the side effects to.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So let's jump to attribution theory. What is the fundamental attribution error in acting versus observing? I'm kind of intrigued in my field that when someone sees a successful investor or trader, they tend to say, well, that guy got lucky. But when they themselves are doing pretty good, instead of crediting luck, it's obviously due to their own skill set. How is that related to the attribution theory?
Well, in a way, that's almost the opposite of the fundamental attribution error. The fundamental attribution error, I attribute behavior to an attribute of the person, a personality trait or an ability that really should be understood in terms of context or situation. But in showing that this is a there's a difference in the likelihood that we make this error for ourselves versus others. If you show people a video of someone behaving in a particular way and ask them why they did it, they'll go for the person's attributes, for their traits, instead of paying attention to the context. But if it's they themselves who are doing this, they're responding to a significant extent to the context. So they say they attribute the behavior, their own behavior, they're much more likely to attribute it to the context of the situation than they would the same behavior by someone else.
That's quite interesting. You mention an endless array of different very famous psychologists and sociologists that you've worked with over the years. Two of the people you discuss really stand out, and I have to reference both of them. There's an old joke about Amos Tversky that says, you know, the Amos Tversky IQ test is the smarter a person is, the sooner they figure out that Tversky is smarter than them.
Right.
Is that your line? In the book, it seems to suggest you're the person who coined that.
Yes, I'm the person who claimed it. It's become, I mean, every psychologist knows that line.
For sure.
I mean, it's interesting that, you know, the smarter you are, the quicker you realize you're not as smart as someone else. Actually, this is related to a Dunning finding, right? I mean, the more knowledgeable people are, the better calibrated they are for understanding the world, for they understand, they know very little about science, so they'll tell you, I don't know. You ask me a question, I can't answer it. I don't know enough. More ignorant people will give you an answer because they don't realize they don't have the wherewithal.
Metacognition has a distinct skill set from actual knowledge of the space.
Exactly. Huh. So the smarter somebody is, the more likely they are to stand aside and not give you an opinion about something if they don't feel like they have sufficient knowledge.
And we're going to spend a little more time talking about intelligence and IQ and how malleable and modifiable that is in a moment. But there's a quote you paraphrase of Hans, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name right, Hans Selye?
Hans, mm-hmm,
that's it. Success in a science is a multiplicative function. It's intelligence times education times ambition times curiosity times hard work times the ability to get along with people and not just super high IQs. Explain that. It's quite a fascinating little formula.
Right. Well, you have to have all those things to be a successful scientist. And my guess is that you have to have pretty much all those things to be successful in business.
Period. Right.
I know someone who had a tested IQ of 184, and he was incredible. I mean, you didn't have to be with him for very long to realize, oh my God, this guy is really super, super smart. But he was slightly autistic. I mean, he was slightly off. He would make comments that were inappropriate. He would laugh when that wasn't the right reaction, and so on. And he had a PhD from a major university, and he only managed to get very middling level jobs, academic jobs in his career. He should have been, you know, at a major university, and he was on very minor places. So that's a case of, you know, that the particular thing that he lacked was ability to get along with people. But ambition is another thing that you often see. If somebody he's got the whole package, but it just doesn't care enough to put it all into play. There's a quote that makes this point, by the way, which I really love, from Warren Buffett, who says, you know, investing is not a game where the smartest guy wins. If you've got an IQ of 160, you may as well sell 30 of those points because you're not going to need them.
And there's a lot to that. You know, it's not just raw processing power. It's judgment and decision-making and the ability to see context. And a lot of those things aren't necessarily IQ. They're a different form of intelligence, which kind of goes to, and I don't want to give the game away because we'll talk about this in a moment, but it kind of goes to the concept that there are a lot of different ways to improve intelligence and improve how successful a person can be. And you point out in the book that the average IQ score in developed Western economies has risen over the past century. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, it actually probably started with the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you have a workforce that needs to be able to read and write and do arithmetic. So you start increasing the amount of schooling, introducing it, or if it's already there, sort of, in embryo, you enhance the education. And for the last 200 years, the amount of time that people spend in school has just kept on increasing. This is hard to believe, but right after World War II, only about 6 or 8% of the population had a college degree. And college does make you smarter. And by the way, I have data about that if you want to hear about that.
Sure.
To my surprise, I really didn't. I just thought, you know, college teaches you stuff. I didn't realize it actually makes you smarter in lots of very important ways.
Well, it does both, right? It teaches you things, but it also gives you a framework to think about things. It's more than just here's a list of data points, memorize them. It's here's how to here's a set of cognitive rules and mental models that you can use to solve problems.
Exactly. An example that I like is I have lots of my studies and lots of Tversky and Kahneman studies, by the way, had to do with showing the errors in reasoning that people make because they don't think statistically or probabilistically when they should. I mean, it's these habits of thought are not, they're not common. We're not typically taught them in such a way that they can make contact with everyday life events. For example, one of their most famous studies is you say, there's a town where there are two hospitals. One has about 15 births per day, and the other has about 60 births per day. At which of these hospitals do you think there would be more days in the year when 60% or more of the births were boys? Most people say, well, it shouldn't make any difference. And about as many say it would be the larger hospital as would be the smaller hospital. In fact, it's astronomically more likely to happen at the smaller,
one, right.
15 births.
Right, you're more likely to get a random outcome with a smaller data set than you are with a larger data, four times larger data set.
Right. I mean, you're going to go far away from 50% if there's three births per day,
right.
Because it's going to be either two-thirds, zero,
100%,
or
right.
Three-thirds boys. I mean, that's... So that's a case. We understand the law of large numbers, by the way. Even hunter-gatherers understood the law of large numbers in a lot of important contexts. But we don't have it stored away as an abstract rule to any time there's a little light that goes on in our heads to say, oh, data, what's the N? What's the number of cases? My favorite example of somebody not using the law of large numbers and not understanding that the more variable the dimension you're looking at, the more data it's important to have to make a judgment. And this comes from when I went for the first time to Europe. I spent about a week in London, a week or 10 days, and it was absolutely gorgeous weather. I mean, blue sky, 70 degrees every single day. And I came away sort of with a lingering feeling that, you know, the British are such complainers. They actually have wonderful weather, but they're always complaining about the rain.
Right.
Well, I got what I deserved the next time I went to London. It never stopped raining the entire time. So now, I wasn't so foolish as to think that weather isn't as variable in England as it is anywhere else, but I just didn't take the trouble to say, wait a minute, how much evidence do I really have about what the weather is? So, at any rate, I studied people's failure to apply the law of large numbers when they should. They're attributing causality when the data they have is purely correlational. I studied their inability to apply the regression, statistical regression concept to problems, and so on. And when I was doing that work, I used to say, you know, not only are we stupid, but you can't make us smarter with these things. So one day I said, well, you know, I'm going to prove that. I mean, I don't actually know for a fact that, you know, you can't teach people these things. To my astonishment, in 15 or 20 minutes, you can teach the law of large numbers, the regression principle, the cost-benefit principles, including a crucially important one of the sunk cost principle, I can't retrieve money I've already spent by consuming something. So, you know, I bet go to a movie and it's a lousy movie, you know, I may say, well, I don't want, this thing is hardly worth it. I'd just as soon be sitting at home. But, you know, I don't want to waste the money I paid, you know, which an economist says, honk, wrong. You can't waste that money. You already wasted it. All you can do now is send good money after bad.
You talk about this with books, and I had this experience more or less around the same time you did, the realization that, hey, I'm not liking this book. I'm under no obligation to finish it. It's not homework. I didn't sign a contract. If I'm not enjoying it, put it aside. I know people who have a real emotional difficulty in saying, no, no, I started it. I have to finish it.
Oh, I was absolutely, you know, pathological. I mean, if I started, by God, I was going to finish it. And I don't know who told me that that's a good rule. I guess I just invented it myself. But, of course, it's a perfectly terrible rule. At whatever point you're not enjoying or you're not learning, then you should stop. People don't have that principle at such a level of abstraction that it will make contact with all the problems in life that it should. You teach them in the laboratory just a very few problems using one of these principles, or actually just giving them the abstract principles. And either one will help people. And if you give them both, abstract and concrete cases, of course, they do even better. So I decided to say, well, what does college do for you on these things?
Mm-hmm.
And I gave them a package of problems like the that are solvable by using the sunk cost rule or the law of large numbers or the concept of statistical regression, which is that extreme events are not likely to be so extreme the next time they're encountered. We don't have that wired into us. I mean, it's a tremendously important principle that we, you know, it doesn't come with the hardware.
Or the software, for that matter.
What's that?
Or the software. It doesn't come with the
software. No, not even the software.
When in a few million years of evolution would we have ever experienced things like exponential growth or compounding? If it never comes up, it's just a total blind spot to us until we're walked through.
Right. Exactly.
Although that said, I've watched people get the Monty Hall problem explained to them. Do you stay with your original choice of the three doors, or once a door is revealed, do you switch? Even after you lay out the statistics to people, a lot of people still refuse to accept that the odds have changed and you should switch.
Right. So we looked at all of these kinds of things, and they were just simple problems like I've just been talking about. Or you tell people, at the end of the first couple of weeks of the baseball season, there are usually several batters with averages of 450 or higher,
right.
But no one ever finishes the season with that high on average. Why do you suppose that is? Now, if you ask this question of a U of M freshman before he set foot in the classroom, he will say, and I'm making it he because he's more likely to know about baseball, he will say, well, you know, the pitchers make the necessary adjustments or, they're doing so well, they kind of goof off and stop trying as hard. After an education lasting 4 years at the University of Michigan, they're likely to say, well, wait a minute. Early on in the season, there haven't been that many at-bats.
Right.
I mean, think about it. After your first at-bat, your average is either zero or one. So when you get more and more, but nobody really has a 450 level of ability, and that's going to show over the long haul. So, I mean, it goes from like 10% giving you that kind of answer to 60 or 70% giving you that kind of answer. I mean, college is hugely important for making you smarter. Peter Thiel, to the contrary, notwithstanding. And so this was, I was bowled over by this. I couldn't, again, it's a tremendously strong effect. I mean, it's people go on average from answering 20% of our problems correctly to 70% of our problems correctly. None of these things that, you know, the statistical rules, probabilistic rules, economic rules, psychological rules, none of these things are taught explicitly nearly as much as they should be. I went and got, after I did the study, I went and got an economics texts to see what they did with the sunk cost. And both of them, they spoke of it only in business situations. They didn't say, oh, by the way, this principle is important to you every day in many, many ways, or the opportunity cost principle. They make no effort. And statistics courses make no effort to say, look, statistics is relevant, you know, all the time, and probability and so on. So there are opportunities to do to greatly improve people's education. Won't affect their IQ, but it sure as heck makes them smarter. And it's tragic that these things are rarely taught, certainly not in the way of that will make contact with everyday life events in high school. Instead, we make high school students take algebra, which they're not going to use. I mean, a tiny fraction are ever going to use algebra. And tragically, a lot of people drop out of high school because they can't hack algebra. Well, algebra ought to go out of the curriculum, as far as I'm concerned, and put probability, economics, and statistics in.
Yeah, I think that's a fabulous suggestion. Last question in this segment on thinking. You've now been at the University of Michigan for quite a long while. Tell us about how you came to leave Yale and end up at Michigan.
Right. Well, my story there appalls most people who hear it.
That's why I asked.
So I was at Yale, perfectly good university, and I went to Michigan, despite the fact that the day of my interview, it was in February. Ann Arbor is not a lovely place in February, it may surprise you to know. And this was a particularly unlovely day because there was dirty, patchy snow lying all around. It was very cold. I was interviewed by the executive committee of the department, and most of the time the discussion was spent with them discussing baseball, which I know nothing about and isn't really relevant to my career. And I spent the bulk of my time, well, not the bulk, but the single person I spent most time with is a colossal bore. But I went to the University of Michigan anyway. In fact, I made up my mind I would go to the University of Michigan absolutely regardless of what happened when I was there, because I had heard only good things about the university, about the psychology department, about the town, et cetera. I'm going to improve my life in all of these ways, and I'm not going to pay any attention to the concrete data which I get. And that's a huge bias that we have. You know, if I saw it, it must be real. Well, no, it might not be. You have better ways of finding out what an object is like than examining it yourself. You know, that's what we have speech for, and the ability to read, and we can get information rather than relying on our own senses. And it was, in fact, the absolute right decision for me. So I got what I deserved.
Quite interesting. Let's talk a little bit about some of the impact of your research on geography of thought. I'm kind of intrigued by the conclusion that we focus way too much on genetics, and we really should be paying a whole lot more attention to the environment, the culture, and the society. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I had studied reasoning for many, many years, and if you're a psychologist, you sort of keep up on the literature on many fields, and one of them that most psychologists know something about is intelligence. But for some reason, I got to thinking seriously about the intelligence literature, and the more I thought and the more I read, the more I realized that psychologists had gotten things desperately wrong with intelligence. And there's a book that has all these desperately wrong things in it. It's called The Bell Curve, and most of your listeners believe what the bell curve tells them. They believe that genetics accounts for 60 to 80% of the variation that you find in intelligence. They think that early childhood environment is not all that important, unless it's their own kid, and they're desperate to get him in the very best daycare situation, which is a mistake. They underestimate the lifetime learning opportunities that make us much smarter or not, as the case may be. They think that blacks and whites are separated in their IQ scores on the average by 15 points. They think, well, probably maybe some of that's genetic. They think Asians have higher IQs than your people of European descent, and so on. And all of that is wrong. And I wrote a book called Intelligence and How to Get It, which shows what's wrong with all of that. The arguments are pretty complicated in the case of, for example, how much of IQ is due to your genes. The most interesting thing I can say about it, first of all, I don't know what the contribution of genes is. I know it's less than 60, way less than 80% of the variation. And the most interesting and important thing I can say about genes and intelligence is that the contribution to the IQ of a population of upper middle class people only is about 80%. It is huge. The variation that you see between people who were raised in upper middle class environments is largely variation that's produced by their genes. In this country, the contribution to IQ of genes of the lower class is practically zero. Now, how could that possibly be? Well, because upper middle class families are all alike. They're like happy families.
Right.
Happy families are all alike. Upper middle class families are all alike with respect to cognitive skill. They're very good, and there's not that much variation. I mean, lawyer Smith and businesswoman Jones, their kids are all getting essentially the same environment with respect to cognitive skill training.
So wait, let me interrupt you here. So when you say the same environment, they read, their parents pay attention to them, they go to even a decent school, and so everybody who has that similar upper middle class or even middle class background is going to take the most advantage of their own genetic background. But working class students, you're suggesting, get almost none of that.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Yeah, because of the chaos that you find in many of those families.
And this has nothing to do with race. This has nothing to do with religion. This is right. really everybody just scrapping really hard to make ends meet, and it's not the ideal circumstance for raising a child.
Right. And, you know, some environments, obviously lower-class environments, are as good as you would ever find in an upper-middle class, but some of the environments are chaotic in the extreme, and not much goes on that's going to facilitate somebody rising to their level of ability. And when the environment is massively different across individuals, as it is in the lower classes, then it's the environment that's going to drive the bus, and the genes are not really much relevant. Mm-hmm. A little side point that I'll make here, and this is that this is true only in the U.S. among rich countries.
Oh, really?
In Scandinavia especially, the contribution of genes to IQ is just as great for the lower classes, people with the least money, as it is the most money, because they are making sure that the poorest have good things going on in their environment, schooling and so on, so that genes can express themselves in the lower classes in Europe, especially Scandinavia. So that's the most interesting thing I can say about genes and the environment.
Well, let's stay with this a sec, because you really raise two fascinating questions, and I'm going to assume you answered it in intelligence and how to get it. The first is, what should parents of any economic background be doing to help their children become as intelligent and successful as possible? And then the bigger question is, what should the U.S. as a society be doing?
Yeah, right. Great questions. There is wonderful anthropological work that's gone on looking at where you just live with a family for a few weeks or months and see what goes on. In the upper middle class family, they typically eat dinner together, and mm-hmm. the dinner table conversation is kind of like a tennis game. I mean, dad says something and mom says something and the kid says something and the dad responds to what the kid said and so on. They learn how to think to a significant extent in family gatherings. These kids get taken to the museum. They get read to often by quite good books. In the lower class family, and this is intact. I mean, we're not talking about pathological. I mean, it's, you know, dad's a lunch pail dad, and mom's a homemaker. Intact family. There isn't much in the way of conversation with the kid. You tell the kid what to do, and the kid asks you for something, and that it's just not at all the same thing. There often is some reading in the lower class family. You know, there may be some little golden books. I don't know if they still have those, but mm-hmm. when most of this research was initially done, those were common. And the kid may get read to some. and they don't tend to go to museums. They don't have their information, their fiction of the top level, most interesting, most likely to be food for thought. So there is a huge difference between upper and lower class in cognitive skills. Some of that is undoubtedly genetic. I have no idea what fraction, but we know most of it is environmental. And this comes from studies of adoption. What happens to a kid from a lower class who gets adopted into a middle class family as compared to the kid who stays in the family of origin? And the answer is that's worth 12 to 18 points in IQ. I mean, that's enormous. That's the difference between somebody who might or might not graduate from high school versus someone that you would expect would complete college and might well go on to postgraduate work. And that shows how important the environment is, and that's the end of the question.
So what should a country like the United States be doing if we have the goal of, hey, we want to see more of our kids succeed, we want to level the playing field and make sure everybody has the opportunity to do their best? What is Scandinavia doing that we're not?
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Well, first of all, they have daycare from, I don't know, probably the word go. Daycare it's important. I mean, a good daycare program is important for intelligence, for sure, with respect to specifically IQ. The very best daycare programs that we have, they have an early effect that tends to largely fade on IQ. But the Nobel Prize-winning economist Heckman at University of Chicago has summarized the evidence of what happens to these kids 30 years after they either have daycare or don't. And the difference is, I seem to be only telling you about really big effects today.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like a 50% increase in the likelihood that the kid will graduate from high school, a 50% increase in the likelihood that he'll go to college, cutting in half of the likelihood that the kid is going to go to jail or be a public charge. I mean, stuff is being learned in there about dealing with other people and self-control, cooperation, and so on, that are tremendously, they're not IQ, but they're cognitive skills and social skills with a huge payoff. And by the way, the economists have shown that good daycare pays back in a ratio of 9 to 1.
Wow.
That is $9 gained for every $1 spent on daycare. The gain to the treasury is significant over the lifetime of a kid. So, I mean, it's just so important, that early childhood education. And there, and to the policy thing, of course, in the Democrats' $3.5 trillion hope, there is early childhood care for everybody. That's a huge investment. I mean, it's a hugely valuable investment, not to mention the human suffering and human well-being that are involved.
Quite intriguing. I want to talk about some of the things you've discussed about the state of psychological research and academic research in general. Most importantly, with the reproduction problem, tell us what's happening in the ability to reproduce academic research.
Right. Well, this is a matter of some passion for me, as you might imagine. Several years ago, a psychologist named Brian Nozick and a lot of other psychologists published an article in Science claiming that only 50% of the psychology experiments that they attempted to replicate actually did replicate. By the way, even if that were true, which it isn't, it would be better than what the drug companies do. Their replication rate is significantly lower than 50%. But the research was deeply flawed in many ways. For one thing, a lot of the studies were chosen because someone found the results to be implausible. So only 50% of the, on their face of it, implausible research got reproduced would be the way to describe what they did. But they did a lot of things that were astonishingly far from what the original investigators did. Italians were asked of opinions about African Americans. Well, they don't have the same understanding of African Americans in Italy that we do. People are asked how they would feel about, you know, flubbing a question in college class, and but people who and replicating this by somebody who makes an error in business, quite a different kind of thing. If you improve on this situation, you'll get about 80% of people, of 80% of studies replicating. Just simply asking the investigator of the study, say, look, this is our understanding of what you did. Is that right? And they either say, yeah, go ahead, or no, you're missing something there. Mm-hmm. Just that gets it up to 80%.
Wow.
But in fact, it's extremely misleading to talk about the replicability of randomly selected studies, let alone the replicability of implausible-seeming studies, I started asking people after this came out, can you think of any finding in psychology which seemed interesting and important when it came out that then turns out not to be the case and doesn't replicate? People have to think for a while. I've only got a list of about a half dozen studies like that at this point. So that's enough to tell you we don't have a replicability problem. It's a certain class, you know, run-of-the-mill studies, but if studies, you know, have been vetted appropriately, there's a very low rate of misinformation getting into the system.
And you're talking about actual lab studies, not things like Freud's abstract theory of the id subsequently being replaced by a different thesis of psychology. You're talking about actual experimental psychology.
Right. Let me give you an example. One thing that we haven't gotten onto is how incredibly much we are affected by small situational or contextual things in our lives that we're affected unconsciously. One clever study, you have people hold a pencil in their mouth with the end of the pencil pointing in, which gives you kind of a sourpuss look and feel when you do that. Or you have them hold it between their teeth horizontal to the floor, which makes it you feel like you're smiling. And you have people look at cartoons under one of these conditions or the other, and sure enough, people who have been forced to smile think the cartoons are funnier. Mm-hmm. So then there's like 10 or 20 studies attempting to replicate that effect, and they don't find it. So that study just drops out. People stop referring to it. It doesn't work. It turns out that all of the studies that attempted to replicate this have a video camera on the person. The person knows that he's being watched. The whole point about this thing is that you're unaware in a conscious way of the fact that you're facial expression has been manipulated, and that's what allows the effect to occur.
Right.
So sure enough, when you do it with the video camera, you don't get the effect when you do it without the video camera. You do get the effect. So the work is really very bad. On the other hand, I will say that that article started a movement to look at the practices of psychologists, research practices, and there have been a number of improvements. You're more likely, going back to the law of large numbers, you're more likely to get a spurious result if you use a small number of subjects.
Sure.
Because you may get something happening that isn't very likely to happen. You just used a small enough sample that you get it. So, I went back and looked at some of the studies early in my career, and I was appalled at how few subjects I used, including the studies that I mentioned about externalizing arousal effects. I mean, we had N's of 12 per cell, and that's just it's inappropriate. And over time, I'd, like everybody else, drifted to much larger numbers of cases than that. But now no one would ever use ends as low as most of us used, at least some of the time, decades ago. And there are other practices too, some good, some not so good. But the ones that are good, they're valuable. They have changed people's behavior.
So speaking of doing experiments, I'm kind of fascinated by things like introspective reports, where people are verbally describing what they're thinking about, how they're thinking, and you kind of reach the conclusion that these sorts of things, at best, people can explain what they think they're thinking about, but not really how they actually think. Tell us a bit about that.
Right. Well, some of my favorite studies here about showing that we don't know what's going on in our heads. One beautiful one shows people a matrix of four cells, up, down, right, left, and it tells the subject, I'm going to put an X on the computer screen in one of those quadrants, and I want you to predict where it's going to appear. So early on, the subject does terribly, and he gets better and better as time goes on. That's because there are rules that are determining where that X appears. It never appears in the same quadrant twice. It has to appear in quadrant two before it can appear in quadrant four, etc. Complicated rule system. And we know that people have learned the rules because when you change the rules, they fall back down to chance level. Now, you ask the subject, say, tell me, you were doing so great there, and then it kind of, you know, honest to say, you kind of fell apart. What happened? And I said, well, I just lost the rhythm. we had psychology professors as some of the subjects, and one of them said, well, I think you were showing me distracting symbols subliminally. So here are people learning rules that are quite complicated and no awareness that they've learned those rules at all.
That's quite interesting.
What's that?
That's quite interesting.
Yeah. So the Nobel Prize winner economist, organizational psychologist, cognitive psychologist Herbert Simon won the Nobel Prize and for a while was going around saying, I do think aloud protocols. I have people solve problems and they think aloud, and that tells me the process that they're using to solve the problem. And my reaction was, well, no, it just says that they can tell you how their theory of how they would have solved the problem, which
right.
happens to correspond to your theory, but that not isn't necessarily what's going on. These studies established that. And there was a controversy that went back and forth between Simon and me. He actually gave me a beautiful example of this. He says, you know, when people play their first chess game, they play, they make several moves, and then you ask them why you did that. And they can't tell you. I don't know. I just was moving things randomly. I don't know why I was doing that. And Simon says, no, actually, they were following rules. It's called Duffer's Rules. Everybody plays the same way before they really have gotten any expertise at all. Says then if they continue to play and they read books and they talk to other chess players, they are now beautifully cognizant of what's going on in their head. They can tell you exactly why they moved the rook to this position instead of the bishop and so on, and they're quite accurate. Then if you look at chess masters, I mean world-class players, they're no longer accurate about what they're doing because they've forgotten some of the stuff they learned in books in a conscious way. And it's precisely because they're masters is that they've invented, like they've induced certain rules that they're following, but they're hopeless. An even simpler example is language. We don't know what grammar is. If you try to have people explain English grammar, they're hopeless. they can't say a single correct thing. But nevertheless, we rarely violate those rules. We just don't have a conscious grasp on what they are. So we're constantly learning things, inducing things that we're not aware of in a conscious way, solving problems in an unconscious way. One of my very favorite studies, you have people in a lab, there's two ropes hanging down from the ceiling, there's a bunch of objects lying around on the tables in there, and the experimenter says, I want you to tie the two ropes together, but the problem is they're too short to do that, so you have to find a way. And one way is very obvious, you tie an extension cord to one, and you go over and grab the other, and you can now tie them together. And there are a lot of things like that. And after the subject has been stumped for a while, the experimenter says, they do it another way, and he still can do nothing. So then he goes, he's been wandering around the lab while this is going on, ambling around. He casually puts one of the ropes into motion. Then, typically within 45 seconds, the subject grabs a rope, ties a heavy object like a pair of pliers to it, sets it moving like a pendulum, goes to the other rope, grabs the pendulum rope, and ties them together. And the investigator says, that's very clever. How did you happen to think of that? And again, this is another one of the studies that use psychology professors as subjects. And one says, well, I thought of monkeys swinging through trees across a river. The imagery occurred simultaneously with the solution. And you say, well, do you think it could have influenced you, the fact that I put the rope into motion? No. It's all about monkeys and rivers and swinging and so on. People have no idea why they were able to solve that problem. Now, this is not just a curio. It turns out that the unconscious mind is going on solving problems all the time for free. We're not aware of what's going on, but it's happening, and that's great. I mean, it's most of the stuff that goes on is accurate.
So that reminds me a little bit of some of the split brain experiments where people who have had their, I guess it's the corpus callosum, severed. So what they see in their right eye goes to the left side of the brain, the left eye goes to the right side, but they're not communicating. And if they're shown two different things, two different images in each eye, they're unaware of why they're actually engaging in the sort of behavior they do based on whether something was shown to one side of their brain or the other.
Right.
Is that related to this?
It's a perfect example to bring to this. those people are confabulating. They don't. The investigator has shown them something to the left eye, and that gets incorporated in the person's thinking about what's going on. But it's not conscious. It's not been presented to the verbal hemisphere. So, it's exactly that. It's confabulation. We're confabulating all the time. Huh. So when somebody asks me why I did something, if it's a psychologist, I say, well, you know, bear in mind who I am. I wrote, you know, all those articles about unconscious reasoning. So I don't really know why I did what I did, but I'll give you a story, which sounds acceptable to me and will to you. Now, you can only do this with psychologists. You can't.
Right.
You can't just do this with Aunt Maud, who will think you've finally lost it. But we can put the unconscious to doing more work than it does. And if you have to give it some material to work over. Hmm. So I use my teaching technique, my seminar teaching technique, is I hand out thought questions 1 week for, and that'll be what we'll focus on in the seminar next week. And my joke about that is, this is simple, somewhat like the thought questions you may have seen in other classes, with the difference being that I expect you to have thought about these questions. Now, if I sit down just before class and write the thought questions out, they're not going to be very good, and the class is not going to be great. But if I just sit down for 10 minutes and say, well, what are the main points I want this material to make, and what would I do if somebody raises a particular point, how would I deflect the discussion in that direction, and so on. I don't have to think for long, but then, you know, several days later, without having consciously thought about the thought questions at all, I sit down and start taking the thought questions by dictation. they start flowing out of my pen.
Right.
And it turns out that if you ask highly creative people, I mean the great people, Poincaré, the mathematician, Amy Lowell, the great poet, if you ask them, you know, how did you come up with that, they say something. Well, Poincaré says, well, I put my foot on the, I was on vacation, I wasn't thinking about work at all, and at the moment I put my foot on the step of the bus, it occurred to me that the functions I needed to solve this problem were the very Fuchsian functions that I had used to solve another problem years ago. Hmm. Amy Lowell says, you know, I was in an art museum and I saw a sculpture of bronze horses, and I thought, you know, that might be an interesting topic for a poem someday. Months later, she sits down, and as she says, the poem was there without having thought about it consciously in that period of time. The point being, if you prime the unconscious with something, it'll go off doing work, including at night. I have a friend who said, you know, I'm working on calculus homework problems, you know, I get to problem three and it's not, I can't figure it out, and work for 30 minutes, nothing's happening, so he just goes to sleep. And often it's not, he wakes up and says, oh, that's a bathtub problem. That's all that is.
Amazing.
So a lot of the unconscious work, conveniently enough, gets done while we're asleep.
Huh. That's absolutely fascinating. We've been speaking with Professor Richard Nisbet of the University of Michigan. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure to check out any of the previous 400 interviews we've conducted. You can find those at iTunes or Spotify or your favorite podcast source. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Sign up for my daily reads at ritholtz.com. Check out my regular column at bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps me do these each week. Mohammed is my audio engineer. Paris Wald is my producer. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Michael Batnick is our head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.